All right, I think we are almost there. Yes, now we're here. Hello. Good afternoon, everybody. It is Angie Atkinson, and I am here with the lovely and talented Dana Morningstar, back for another episode of whatever we call this thing, where we hang out every Tuesday. Uh-huh. To come up with a name. Anyway, we do this show, this session, every Tuesday, usually, at 12:30 Central, 1:30 your time, Dana?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Which is Mountain Eastern. Time? Eastern. I'm so challenged. Okay, so we switched channels. What am I doing? Okay, I'm trying to mute myself so I don't hear myself talking. Good, good. Okay, so 1 week we'll be here, and next week we'll be over on Dana's channel, which is Thrive After Abuse, right here on YouTube. And she's also got thriveafterabuse.com, Thrive After Abuse support group on Facebook, and all over the internet at Thrive After Abuse. And Dana, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back.
It is always my pleasure to see you and to have you here and to be over there. Anyway, I'm in awkward mode today.
So that's okay.
Yes. So I'm a little flummoxed today because I recently joined TikTok, and I thought, I'm too old. You guys, there are so many people on TikTok. But anyway, I was watching this video on TikTok just because I'm trying to be supportive of, you know, other people. And also, I admit it's a little addictive. Mm-hmm. I think it's on purpose. But one video that I saw today was this woman, and she said she was the self-proclaimed mom of TikTok. And she started talking about, you know, like she was laying down in her bed. She said, I'm laying here with you and you're a little burrito, you know, blah, blah, talking about whatever. And then she said, you know, did you get some water? Did you get something to eat? Blah, blah, blah. And then at the end, she said, you know, she loves you and have a great day, all this crap. You guys, I was tears for real. Not even kidding. Mm-hmm. and it occurred to me that I was, you know, even though I've been healed for years, I was deeply affected by her because she was doing mommy things, and she was an older lady. No, I mean, older than me, I should say. I'm not saying she's mm-hmm. super old or anything, but not that I'm super young. But anyway, she was someone who was probably about my mom's age. And so it really deeply affected me in a way that I did not expect. And right now, just even talking about it, I feel a little bit teary. So mm-hmm. what I was thinking about before we got here today, Dana and I kind of talked a little bit about it before we jumped in, was, you know, how many of us would be affected this way, whether it's a mom or a dad or someone else, how many of us would be affected deeply by, and you know, her voice was very, very like sincere and sweet. You would just have to see it. I did a little TikTok about it, but I can't post it because I'm too embarrassed. I mean, I posted it there, but I'm not posting it here. My point is, it will affect you. And if you have been raised by someone who is toxic, mm-hmm. especially if it's mother in this case. But something that occurred to me as I was thinking about that and was that this is indicative of what we maybe have, many of us, how we got here, right? How we experienced, how we ended up in toxic relationships with other people, you know, what we were brought up from and how we ended up becoming the people we are today. So I thought, what a great topic for us to talk about. How did we get here? You know, we know it's about, you mm-hmm. know, attachment styles, et cetera. But, you know, I find that probably about 95 to 99% of the clients that I deal with usually, not always, but usually have a certain amount of trauma in childhood, often related, usually related, not always, to parents, mothers and fathers. So I would ask those of you in the chat right now really quick, you know, tell me, have you been affected by a toxic parent or a toxic adult during your own childhood? And if so, if you care to share, was it mother, father, or someone else? Let me know in the chat. And Dana, what are your thoughts about all this?
Yeah, well, I guess a couple different things. The whole kind of mom or dad of the internet or of a certain mm-hmm. site, you're so right that that can really just bring out this deeply emotional response. Mm-hmm. I've seen various like gay pride parades where there'll be both men and women out there that have shirts on that say, or signs that say like, you know, get a hug from a dad. And so they'll take that. I know, right? It makes me like tear up even thinking about it, because you have so many people in that community who have just been isolated or completely abandoned from by their family. And so just getting a hug from somebody else who is a dad, who just says like, you know, I love you and I'm proud of you and you're enough, is just so incredibly powerful.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
The lady said something like that too. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. And so in terms of like how we got here and like the role of a deeply dysfunctional or even just mildly dysfunctional childhood, you know, are the things that happen in our childhood tend to set the tone for what we do as an adult.
Yes.
And the relationships that have been role modeled, you know, I think we all like to think that, you know, so much of our behavior is of our choosing. And the large part of it is that it's not. A lot of it's subconscious, and a lot of that programming comes from childhood.
Yeah.
And stuff that we're not even aware of, like that, oh, that this is a problem, or that this, or that things could be any different. It's just not on our radar until we get older and we see somebody else do something differently. And it's just this huge aha moment. And especially when we're talking about abuse, you know, like abuse and neglect tend to get lumped together. They both have devastating effects. But the challenge, and there's of course challenges with either, but the challenge with emotional neglect, emotional abuse and neglect, is that it's really difficult for a person to identify like what they didn't have. It's one thing when you're abused, it's more of an active process. So it's something is being done to this person. So they can identify, I was hit, I was cussed at, I was put down, I was this, I was that, versus you're just slowly being starved out and people don't realize it. And so then that sets the tone. It definitely makes us a lot more vulnerable to problematic people later on in life, especially with all the love bombing and even still, I mean, this stuff's not taught. So, you know, the opposite tends to be taught of these really twisted ideas about what love is. And so there's a lot of deprogramming across the board that I think needs to happen.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think something you said that really stuck with me was that, I don't know, something you said made me think of this because I, something that I wanted to say. So one thing that I think is important to note as well is, you know, like you kind of implied, you know, we kind of get what we expect, but not exactly. And what I mean by that is, you know, when you are brought up with an abusive or neglectful parent, especially, I mean, I don't even know if it's especially either one, because even when there's physical abuse, there's almost always mental abuse. And I'm not going to talk about my own situation in that way right now, but there were things on both sides. And I think what happens is you learn you're not important, and you learn that you should just take the crumbs and accept whatever it is that someone, you know, leftovers, crap, be grateful when anybody gives you any attention, even if they're a narcissist or toxic or mean or hurtful or whatever. If they say they love you sometimes, and sometimes they give you, you know, some affection, well, that's probably enough, you know, and that's, and you know, and affection is subjective anyway. You know, so I guess my point is, I really think that the type of, you know, when you consider the large percentage of us, now, again, I want to just say not everyone's experienced exactly, you know, not everyone had a bad parent. Not everyone grew up in a bad situation. Some people had other issues. Some people didn't have any trauma, and they just, at, you know, were clueless to the idea that someone could be so toxic. But I think that even those of us who did were still kind of clueless that someone could be that toxic. It was like this twisted view of the world. You know, if somebody, you know, if they, like in my case, that the parent was aggressive and mean and pushy, and my ex was not, or didn't seem to be at first, you know what I mean? Had a different personality, a different attitude. And so I thought, like, different, good. No. And the problem is, I think we are looking for those toxic qualities that we can be aware of when we're not fully like educated about this, because you don't even learn about this type of thing in school. So, right. I mean, so it's, and you should. So I think that's what it comes down to, is we know that attachment styles affect who we become. We know that how we were treated as infants affect who we become deeply long term. But it's for a narcissist, I think it's even in many, especially during infancy, it might be easier to love on and be close to a little baby because it's a little extension of yourself at first. You know, it feels like that. It came out of your body or whatever. So, you know what I mean? And so I remember myself, you know, with my oldest, for example, seeing him start to have opinions of his own and being shocked by this, you know, when he was like two or something. I mean, really before that, if we're honest. But, you know, and recognizing him as a small person. And I don't mean small, I mean small. you know, and I imagined at that time, like, well, you know, I didn't feel like a whole person until I was 35 or so. And I've talked about that before. My youngest, I could tell she knew before she was a year old that she was a whole person of her own. I could tell because she would, like, when we'd sit at the dinner table, she would actively look around and engage and, like, make each person in the family sit and like look at her and listen to her babble and whatever babies do, you know. But she was actively, intentionally engaging with each person at the table like it was her table. And I thought that was super cute, and she still is that person. But it's just interesting to see what happens. So I think it's a fascinating topic, and it really floored me today that I could be so deeply affected by a stranger on the internet who was saying nice words. It's crazy. Anyway, so I forgot to look at the thing from last week. Did you grab the questions, or did we not do that?
People were just saying that they enjoyed the topic.
Okay.
On magical thinking. So.
Oh, good. Oh, we forgot to talk about that. Darn it. Do you want to talk about that again, or do we want to wait and
to the topic? Let's maybe another time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe next week or whenever. Okay. Sorry about that. I totally blanked.
I did too until you just said it. So.
Right on. Yeah. Right on. All right. So I'm going to jump in the chat. Do you have anything else to add to what we're talking about before we?
No. There's a lot of good comments in the chat.
All right, you start us off.
Okay. This is from UNA, who says, my mother could be loving when she wasn't in her crazies. So we walked on eggshells around her and didn't know when the screaming and crazies would come out. Yes. And so that learning that behavior, there's so many messages that we internalize as a child when we grow up with something like that. We learn that that love is conditional, that respect and being treated with respect and dignity is conditional. We learn that walking on eggshells is normal, and it's not a deal breaker, and that's not a sign that something's wrong. And so later when we start dating, we might tend to chalk it up to, oh, we're just very compassionate, or we're very go with the flow, or we're just very understanding, when the reality is our standards for how we are treated is very, very low. And we're highly tolerant of mistreatment across the board, not just extreme abuse, but on that more mild end of, you know, kind of intimidating environments. And intimidating environments can come in that wide range, you know, icy stares, silent treatment. A person doesn't even need to really say anything to create intimidation, but they definitely can. And if they're lashing out, and all of that just seems normal, and we're like, okay, well, I know how to navigate this, you know, then it becomes familiar. And a person that is healthier, has healthier ways of expressing themselves, that starts to feel that's not attractive. And that's kind of a turn off, and we don't know how to interact with that.
Right.
You know, or people might feel like, I think sometimes being around super healthy, like well-adjusted, connected people can make a person that's grown up in an abusive home or a neglectful home painfully aware that they're missing those aspects within themselves. And so it's sort of like, I don't belong here, and I don't want to get too close because they're going to find out and they're going to reject me. So there's a lot of different ways that people that have experienced abuse can avoid, healthy and gravitate towards unhealthy.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would fully agree with that. Ooh, stomach got weird. I have one from Lenita that's just a comment, and I want to touch on it. Lenita Joseph, she says, I don't think I had toxic parents, but they died when I was young. And to me, you know, that's another type of trauma. Certainly you would feel, indirectly, you would feel abandoned, maybe directly, and you would feel like you didn't belong to anyone, or you might. I remember there was a period of time when I was in kindergarten where I guess my mother was going through some difficult things, and she had a hard time. And so I ended up doing second semester of kindergarten at my grandma's house, you know, in the school next to her house. So not only was I moved out of my school, but I was also moved out of the house and away from my family, my brother, all that. And I remember, and my grandma had a daughter my age and two foster kids. So in plenty of room. So it wasn't like I was neglected physically or, you know, anything. Mm-hmm. But it was a different life, and I was scared and sad, and I felt very alone, you know, and it was my grandma, for heaven's sake, you know? But I remember feeling like I didn't belong. And I think that was to anyone at that time. And I feel like that was a different kind of trauma. And it's not the same as losing your parents, but it would felt like a big abandonment. So I guess the reason I wanted to touch on Lenita's comment is because, you know, when kids lose their parents very young, they certainly are going to have additional trauma. And then of course, whatever happens from there, you know, depending on whether you just felt alone, or you felt like you didn't belong, or you felt like you were neglected, or even if you were abused by whoever did end up raising you, you know, I think that can also affect your ability to form the boundaries that you need to not accept toxic people. Because I think, you know, a lot of people say, well, why do we attract toxic people? Well, we do, for sure, but it's not because there's something wrong with us per se. It's because we accept them, because I don't think toxic people are only attracted to like empaths or whatever, but I think they stick around because we let them, and because we end up doing things like walking on eggshells and letting them run our days and our emotions and our, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, what are your thoughts on that? Anything?
Oh, I agree 100%. You know, if we've grown up or spent a significant portion of our life mm-hmm. where we haven't been in tune with our boundaries, mm-hmm. where we don't know where our boundaries are, we don't know when they've been crossed, unless it's really extreme, unless it's something like, and we've talked about this before, but have a lot of people, us included, are like, okay, well, I would leave a relationship if I was cheated on or hit.
Right.
Right. Everything else is workable. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a sign of poor boundaries, because yes. there's a lot of other gray area in there that comes before that, that is absolutely in that deal breaker territory. At a minimum, it's valid to be addressed and resolved. Mm-hmm. And so if we've grown up kind of like what UA was saying, in these environments where it's the only way to stay quote unquote safe is to walk on eggshells, because that's, as a kid, you have no power. Mm-hmm. So you can't leave. Right. Yep. So it's sort of like, okay, how am I going to endure this mistreatment? And so, you know, when our boundaries have been crossed, if we're not aware of where those boundaries are, then it's, our defense strategy tends to be compliance mm-hmm. and, you know, just, yeah, people pleasing.
Yeah. We come from a place of, please don't leave me, you know, instead of yeah. I deserve, you know. And that's why I think it's so important for us to become emotionally independent, if not otherwise independent. You know, I love the idea of not having to have, you know, of being able to take care of myself no matter what. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big, huge thing that I think we all can. I think we all don't know that we can, though. Do you know what I mean? Uh-huh. So, keep bumping my arm. Okay. I have this comment from the UK lady. I just want to add in, and then we'll, and then.
Sure.
Okay. Because it kind of goes along with what we're saying. She said, I feel that people often accept the love they think they deserve and repeat relationship patterns. Totally 100% agree with that. Yeah. All right. What were you going to say? Or did you have a question?
Here's another comment from the chat. This is from Karen, who says, how about the severe alcoholic? And yes, both were alcoholic people and wasn't seen. Now I gravitate towards these people. We attract these people because we believe it's familiar. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great point. That's another form of potentially abuse, but definitely neglect, is when you have a parent who's lost an addiction.
Yes.
And they're not emotionally or sometimes physically present. And then that's its own set of challenges too, because there might be that very marked difference between sober parent and not sober parent.
Yes.
And so for a child, that creates a lot of instability in their life. And, you know, and depending on that parent, and, you know, they might have times when they're kind of, you know, using or drinking or whatever, where they're not there. They might do or say hurtful things or forget or whatnot. But then when they're sober, it kind of gets back to that love bombing. And it might be completely sincere of like, oh, I love you so much. And, you know, telling the child kind of everything to reassure them. But again, the message the child gets from that is, oh, well, nobody's perfect. So basically tolerate this. Right. And then it gives confusing ideas about what love is. You know, it's like, okay, well then love sometimes hurts, and love is unreliable, and love, you know, it kind of weaves in a lot of really dysfunctional ideas about love.
Yes. It really, absolutely 100% agree. Yep. Yeah. I'm seeing a lot of people in the chat talking about their own, childhood, you know, their parents, and it's powerful stuff. And, you know, this is why it's so, well, like you and I said, she is always astounded when someone has a loving male parent, astounded and can't wrap her head around it. It's in like an alien concept. And she said, not like I feel a wanting for it, more like I can't even imagine it. I get that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's all quite powerful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Karen says, we think it's okay to be abused and neglected. It's not okay, but we can't identify exactly. I think she meant to add why we don't know it's not okay, or why it's not okay sometimes.
Yeah. It's a big part of healing is to wake up and step into that awareness is what I'm trying to say. Stepping into that awareness of when we're being treated in a way that we're not okay with, and how to do something about it. So like there's different layers of awareness that I think everybody goes through on this journey. The first one is, you know, like with most things, it's the low hanging fruit, like the things that are the most obvious. It's kind of, oh, okay, extreme abuse, physical, psychological, emotional, whatnot. That's not okay. Like this is what it is, and this is not okay. And people are like, okay. And then it's kind of the next layer and the next layer to that, where it eventually peels back to being aware of when you're being treated in a way that's just simply not comfortable for you. The person doesn't have to be a narcissist. They could have great intent. They could be well-intentioned. You know, it doesn't have to be this extreme situation. It can just be there. Somebody's doing something that's not okay with you, and how to assert ourselves and handle that situation appropriately. So,
totally agreed. Let's see here. Do you have another comment for us?
Let's see. I can scroll. Do you have one?
Yeah, I'm seeing it. Okay. I have, Karen said she loves both of us for making us feel seen us as in our community, and to understand this is abuse. And this is why we do what we do. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely.
Sonia says that I was the first one she saw regarding narcissism. I saved her life in so many ways. Thank you. And she said, Dana, you so rock as well. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Indeed. let's see.
Here's a comment from Karen who says that we accept what we can't change, but we know it's not okay. Just toxic people, and we want to be loved. We accept what we can't change. Yeah. I mean, that's a big part of it, accepting what we can't change. And I would also add to that, and not internalizing it either. So
accept what you can't change, but also don't. I think the thing we forget when we think about that is, okay, I accept it, but that doesn't mean I have to sit around and keep living it. Right. And I think that's the part that I had a little trouble figuring out at the beginning. I thought as long as I had someone, it was better than no one. And that's just obviously not the case. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the biggest shifts for me with relationships and friendships and everything across the board was that it wasn't that that relationship could not be held together based on how I felt about the person. Mm-hmm. It was just as much, if not more so, about how they treated me.
Mm. Yeah.
Whereas before I was like, oh, I'm with this really toxic guy dating him and he treats me like plan B. Mm-hmm. I'm always on the back burner. I'm not a priority. He doesn't really care. There's a lot of gaslighting. Of course, I didn't know all those terms at the time, right. But there's a lot of like denial, deflection, blame, all of this kind of stuff. But I stayed with him because I had feelings for him.
Yeah.
And now I realize it doesn't, that might sound kind of minimizing, but it really, we can't let our feelings dictate whether or not we're in a relationship or not, because it's feelings come and go, and we can have feelings for all kinds of reasons other than what's healthy.
Yes.
And so realizing like, okay, I can still be attracted to somebody, but if they're not treating me correctly, then I need to go.
Yep. 100%.
I need to handle those feelings on my own.
Yes. So. Yep. And here Shiloh says, I was so unworthy of love that I married an abusive man. My mom said that she was glad he died because she didn't like him. That was the support she showed the second she found out he was gone. I'm so sorry. First of all of that in itself is serious trauma, because not only did you lose your husband who also abused you, but you then had your mother not even say, I'm so sorry, not even hug you, or, you know, that's really not okay. But that's a perfect example of what we're talking about here, because I did the same thing. Mm-hmm. I thought I was unworthy of love. And so I did the same thing. And dated them and, you know, was friends with them, all the things, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. So it is what it is. But I think what it comes down to, is that this is what I see in, like I said, a large percentage of my clients and of people in our support groups and things like that. And here on YouTube, I see it almost consistently. So that's why we talk about all the things. Mm-hmm. Do you have another question or comment, or do you want to say anything about
I have a question here from Shiloh, who asks, I was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder due to my mother's abuse. Has anyone else had the same diagnosis for this reason?
I've heard many people having that, being diagnosed that way in our community. Mm-hmm. I think on some level, sometimes it's accurate. And I also think sometimes it's not accurate. I think sometimes mm-hmm. really what you're looking at is PTSD or CPTSD as a result of the abuse. But I think it just depends on the healthcare provider. And I would always get a second opinion if you could do that, if that's how you've been diagnosed. But in either case, if you're able to acknowledge whatever it is that's going on with you, then you can work past it, work through it, unlike mm-hmm. a narcissist. So Dana, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, especially borderline personality disorder, you know, that tends to be the result of abuse and neglect. Mm. So it's a combination of like nature and nurture. But I would also, with that said, I would say that nurture plays a large role in it. So if a child grows up in an abuse and neglect or neglect, they will develop complex post-traumatic, more than likely, some sort of complex post-traumatic stress, because it's ongoing abuse instead mm-hmm. of PTSD, which tends to be like a one-time traumatic event. But the result of that, if because trauma causes behavior changes in people, if those aren't able to be adjusted and resolved, then the result tends to be a personality disorder. And all a personality disorder is it's a kind of pervasive and persistent problematic behavior. Mm-hmm. So it's maladaptive ways of kind of reacting and responding and interpreting the world around us. But like Angie was saying, if you break it down and look at it in terms of problematic traits, those can be, especially with borderline personality, those can be identified and addressed, and many can be significantly resolved mm-hmm. with therapy.
Yeah.
So Yeah, and it is very common. I would say borderline personality disorder, CPTSD, PTSD, depression, anxiety, eating disorders, addictions are very, very common. I would yes. say upwards of like 90% of our community, if I had to put a number to it.
I would agree. And I mean, sometimes they're going to be, you know, there are different, it's all a spectrum is my point. So you might have someone who, you know, just eats a little too much or works out a little too much, or you might have someone on extreme ends, you know what I mean?
Right.
Of scales. And so, for example, so I mean, yeah, I've seen some difficult things, but you know what I think, you know, when you look at the borderline stuff, you know, I think if we're all, I think we could all find something in ourselves that we could go, maybe, you know, but the difference again, that, cause I could look at that at the borderline diagnosis and I could see things about it that might, you know, maybe, okay, well, maybe, but I'm not diagnosed. I don't believe I have that issue, but I do think that I have trauma issues that I've mostly worked through. But again, mm-hmm. obviously I was triggered by a stranger on the internet today. So, and I ugly cried and everything. It was so weird. Not on the video that I reacted video, but, privately. So it definitely, it's strange the way it affects you long-term, even when you, like I said, you've worked through it, you mm-hmm. do all the things. First of all, let me say this really quick, guys. For those of you in chat, I saw that I was on YouTube automatically put me on like a top chat or something. So I switched to live chat and then it dropped me down to the point at which I guess it had gone. So UK ladies comment, which I'm about to read, is the first one that I have in my little queue right now. So if you've asked a question before that and Dana didn't grab it, you might want to ask it again. Okay. UK lady said compliance and you read that one already. Compliance and people pleasing is what I aim to address in therapy. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's a response to what you were saying. And those are important things. I think it's all about boundaries, you know, setting boundaries and learning how to not apologize for them and to uphold them regardless of how uncomfortable it becomes, because I can't tell you how many times I've allowed crap to happen to me because mm-hmm. I was too afraid to enforce a boundary, you know, and I think we probably could all on some level relate to that, right?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I'm still a work in progress with that. There are times where, you know, I'm not aware that a boundary has been crossed and it's maybe a few days later that I'll realize it. And so it's definitely, you know, a journey with that. And like you were saying, Angie, with certain traits with borderline personality disorder or whatnot, like all of this stuff, it's within the range of normal human behavior. It's just the degree and frequency that it becomes, the degree and frequency, kind of that pervasiveness or persistence of it, as far as how, if it would register as a personality disorder. So like with borderline personality, being very emotionally reactive, kind of feeling all the feels and reacting to them is one key sign. Severe fears of abandonment, and oftentimes very impulsive actions taken to avoid abandonment. And kind of a very fragile or undefined sense of self.
Yes.
So there's just, in the result of that, it's sort of like always, you know, kind of like you were saying, like not feeling like a full person or not being very easily influenced or being very impressionable by others. And it's that go with the flow kind of stuff. And a lot of that's just common from, it's a common trauma response, you know, and so I guess the point of what I'm saying is if anybody has experiencing some of these symptoms, don't panic. A lot of this stuff can be resolved, but knowledge of the issues, the challenges that you're having is a big step. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely true. Do you have another comment or I have
do.
One if you
don't? Yeah, okay, go ahead. Okay, this is from BB, and then there's a follow-up from UK lady. BB says, you know, you have to ask yourself, what would the average person do? And then UK lady says, you know, I keep asking myself, if I saw this on TV, would I accept the behavior?
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. That's very similar to my sort of different, but similar to my sort of go-to tactic for self-talk. I always ask myself, what would I say to my kid? And, how would I talk to my kid if my kid was the one who experienced whatever this was that I'm going through or dealing with? It's always different than I would talk to myself, much nicer. And I think, especially when we've had parents like this, we sort of have to reparent ourselves. And so I think that's what it comes down to. What I mean is that particular thing, it kind of sounds weird, but we have to be our own parent. But when we think about, and it doesn't have to be your kid, it could be if you don't have a kid, it could be your best friend or your little cousin or niece or nephew or grandchild. I guess you wouldn't have a grandchild if you're not a kid anyway. But you get what I'm saying. The point is someone you love unconditionally, even if it's your pet. How would you talk to someone like that about whatever you're going through, and then talk to yourself the same way? Any other thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah, there's that whole saying of like you are as deserving of your care, kindness, compassion, and consideration as anybody else. And it's so
Yes.
true. I mean, you think about even how we tend to treat people, even if they're not somebody that we love, even if it's just somebody like an acquaintance, right? There's still like that, the way we talk to an acquaintance, like there's something really wrong there. If the way we talk to an acquaintance is better than the way we talk to ourselves. And yeah. That can be very eye-opening of, oh my
Really?
gosh, I would never talk to like
Right.
another person like this. Why am I talking to myself or
Right.
allowing other people to talk to me like this?
Exactly. 100%. So let's see. Nance adds, if you leave, you almost feel as though you are tainted, as that is what you're taught to believe. And that's also true, I think. One of the things that, we feel tainted, or like even if it, I felt tainted for life, like from the beginning. I always felt like I was like not as, even if I showered 27,000 times, I never felt clean. And I don't know, you know what I mean? Like it's never, there's something, and I don't mean physically, I mean some other kind of way. There was always something that I felt was not the same about me, different than everyone else. So I get that feeling about being tainted, and that continued. Then I had to get divorced, and I didn't want to get to, you know what I mean? I had to do all these, and so then I was a single mom. It was like this whole process that nobody wants to know. Anyway, so I get that. Any thoughts on being tainted?
Well, and I think another way that that can definitely surface is if you have that narcissistic person who's continually telling you that it's your fault. See,
Of
you're the
course.
problem. You ruined a good thing. I'm a good catch. Anybody else would love to be with me. You just don't appreciate it. And it's all of that crazy making of, well, who's the problem? Is it me or is it them?
And then they jump into a relationship immediately, and so you have to assume they're right.
Well, and they look so happy, right?
Right.
All over the internet. And you're like, oh my God, well, maybe I am the problem. And so, and there can also be that grinding down of somebody's self-esteem of you're not, you're stupid, you're fat, you're ugly, you're all of these things, nobody's going to want you, da 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 da. And so then that person, if we're taking that as truth, feeling less than and absolutely just kind of tainted and like unworthy.
No doubt about it. Let's see. Oh, C. Griffin says her husband and she are in therapy. She says, because he has betrayed me without cheating. I said therapy or leave. I was told by family that making threats of leaving is unhealthy. I mean, I think what's unhealthy is that he betrayed you. I do think you should be willing to leave, if either he refused or he goes to therapy and then you don't find resolution in a reasonable amount of time. I don't know if your husband is a narcissist or not, but if he is, then it might be not as effective as you would hope. But if he could just be just a broken person in a different way, then maybe. Dana, do you have any thoughts about being in therapy? I mean, if he is a narcissist, I would say don't do therapy with him. But what are your thoughts?
I guess it depends on what the betrayal is. She said that he betrayed her, right? But that it wasn't cheating?
That's what she said.
Okay. Yeah.
It's hard to say.
It's hard to say, but you know, I think the bigger issue there is, you know, if there's a betrayal there, then there's also lying. There's deceitfulness. There's a breakdown of communication. There's a breakdown of trust. There's a breakdown of a lot of other things. Right. Whether or not those can actually be effectively addressed and resolved is another story. I agree with you 100%, Angie. If he were to get into therapy, if whoever posted this, I would encourage you to exactly what Angie said, get clear on a time frame and the kind of results that you're looking to see, because a person can be in therapy for years, if not decades, and the needle doesn't move.
Right.
Or they might tell you everything you want to hear. But the difference is if there has, when, like I said, there's a betrayal, there's deceit, and there's a breaking of trust, a breaking of honesty, a breaking of loyalty, a breaking of a lot of different things, are they have to be willing to do the work to repair the damage done. So the work isn't on you to somehow relearn how to trust them. The work is on them to have to live a life of total transparency and in rebuild trust and reassure you enough that, that this won't happen again. So what this doesn't look like, which is what we tend to get a lot of in this community, is them getting defensive, them not wanting to live a life of transparency, not wanting to answer questions, only wanting to give partial truths, telling part of the story, insisting that, oh, that was a long time ago, you need to get over it, or you're just looking for a fight or whatever, and them kind of doing the bare minimum to keep a person around. And then the person on the receiving end basically tying themselves into knots, trying to learn how to trust again, when the reality is it's not healthy or reasonable to trust a person who hasn't shown you that they're trustworthy. And that just takes time and actions, appropriate actions.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. Yep. Hufflemom, do you have a comment for us? I didn't
actually
mean to keep talking.
I wanted to go back to that whole therapy thing again, because this was just another thought that popped in my mind. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, if he goes into therapy, that he's going to be telling his side of things. Okay.
Yep.
And it's not going to be your side of things. And it's probably not going to be an accurate, fair, and balanced side of things. It's going to be a lot of him justifying, minimizing, rationalizing why he did what he did. And if he doesn't have a really solid therapist who can see BS for BS, or at a minimum can call out kind of stuff and hold him accountable for his actions, then there's a very good chance that he's going to be coming back and telling you, well, this is what my therapist said. And because, and he might not even be aware that he's painting himself as this sympathetic character, and that the therapist is buying into this. And the reality is, the whole concept of accountability and appropriate behavior and responsibility isn't being adequately addressed. So if he comes back to you and says that his therapist said X, Y, and Z, or whatnot, don't let him use that against you. And I would actually, if it, and again, Angie, I don't know all the details or even really any of the details, but at a minimum, I find it's always helpful, unless we're talking about somebody who's a pathological liar, like, you know, if this was an event and not a pattern kind of thing, to do a few couples sessions. So that way the therapist at least has your perspective and a fuller version of the truth.
Yeah, they are doing couple sessions, it looks like. She said they are in therapy together. Okay. But so everything you said is entirely accurate. But I would add that I can't tell you how many therapists I have in my support groups and in my client roster. They don't always catch it. Narcissists are really good at fooling people. And I've myself been, even, you know, in the last year, I had a couple and I was fooled for a minute. You know, and I kind of do this sort of thing for a living. I was fooled by the narcissist for a minute. So it you have to be careful who you choose and what you do with that person, and make sure that the therapist understands. And if you go into sessions and you start to find yourself feeling like the therapist is missing the point or not getting, you know, is falling for the BS, consider a different therapist or consider moving on. Just something to think about. I know marriage isn't so easy to walk away from, but throwing it out there. Okay. Yes. Anyway, I want to talk about Helpful Mom said, I found that learning to love myself, though it's been a challenge, has helped me to walk away from my codependent and enabling behavior. And I think that is 100% what it's all about. Although I always used to say self-love, 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 and I still do. But Dana, you taught me, a year and a half, 2 years ago, I think now, or a year ago, I don't know, long time ago, a while ago, you taught me that some people, and you were right, some people do not feel comfortable with the idea of self-love. So now I say first accept yourself, then you can learn to love yourself, accept yourself as you are in any given moment. And for me, that has been very difficult at times, but whenever I notice that I'm not doing that, I step back and reevaluate and try to figure out, okay, is there something I could change? Is there something I have just, you know, like I'm a little older than I used to be, my face looks a little different, you know, or my, you know, whatever. Some things you can, some things you can't, some things you could, but choose not to. Like I choose currently not to get plastic surgery to or Botox or anything like that, because I feel like the risk outweighs the benefits for me at this time. I'm not saying that's going to always be the case, and I'm not against it. I'm just choosing not to do it at this moment. So I could change the face is my point, but I don't care. It's fine for me, you know, just a face. But my point is that's a surface level sort of thing. But even on a deeper level, you know, there are certain things you could change, certain things you might not be able to change, and certain things you could change, but you might choose not to change. In any case, you have to accept where you are and who you are in any given moment. And I think that for me, just like for Helpful Mom, was an incredibly powerful realization. And it, again, it didn't hit me until I was much older. but I now can say I actually do love myself. And then that's pretty awesome and amazing. So I think when you fall in love with yourself, and I don't mean in a weird way, I mean in a healthy, normal way. I don't even know if there is a weird way, but I'm sure there is. then it does change everything. I remember when I had this realization, oh my gosh, I cannot believe I was mad. How dare they treat me that way? That's how I knew it was going to be okay. I got indignant. And I realized I had been allowing people to walk all over me for my whole life, starting very early and continuing into my adult relationships. And at some point I was like, no, this is, I woke up. And I, even when I first realized what was going on, and I was sad, confused, angry, all those things, I didn't fully get it. And I seriously, like, part of me was like, I feel like I'm lying to myself. And that's because you're taught to not believe what you think or feel. So it took me a while to get past the voices telling me that I was just stupid and lazy and crazy and all the other things I'd been told, you know? So, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thoughts on that?
Yeah.
Walking away with self-love. Go ahead.
Yeah. One of the big shifts for me, because I really struggled with that same concept for a long time. And I thought, well, I guess I don't hate myself. Like, there's things I want to change, but like, I don't hate myself. So when people talked about self-love, it was like, yeah, I mean, I guess I love myself. Like, I don't really know what that means. You know, it was just kind of empty words.
Right. Yes.
But then changing out the word love to value, like, okay, do you value yourself? I was like, oh, like a light bulb went on. And it was like, well, when you put it that way, like everything changes. Like, do I value myself? Like, what does that look like to value myself? And basically it boils down to treating myself with dignity and respect. And I think that's a really accurate way to describe love. Like, love is dignity and respect. If those two things aren't there, then love is not present. And love is not infatuation. Love is not intense emotions. Like, all of that, that's infatuation. Like, that's not love. Love is that deep appreciation. Yeah. And so when we view it that way, the actions that we take towards self-love or loving others, it very different. And things radically start changing when we start valuing ourselves.
Mm-hmm. No doubt. Yep. Yeah. I totally agree. Okay. Do you have another one for us? If not, I do.
Go for it.
Okay. This is from Lori Ray Morris, and she says, I remember my mom is, I'm remembering when my mom, I am remembering my mom in a clothes store when I was less than five. She was just on the next aisle. She laughed at me and just patted me and said, oh, I'm right here. It was a moment of abandonment, but it was happening in different ways so often. And see, and a lot of times people will hear what Lori said and say, it's not that serious, Lori, get over it. But the fact is that that little cross section of a memory, it my guess is that it probably represents a lot more of your childhood than people would acknowledge, you know, because I'm thinking to myself, I have three kids. Would I have ever walked into the next aisle of a store? To be fair, I live in it, or, you know, I've lived in some populated areas, but mm-hmm. would I ever walk into the next aisle of a store and leave a five-year-old hanging? No, not even if it wasn't my own child, mm-hmm. if it was my responsibility to take care of the child. So I think there's definitely a significant symbolism in that memory, I would assume, because it makes you feel not just abandoned in the moment, but I can relate to that. Actually, when I was five, kindergarten, I came home from school one day and there was no one there, and this was not supposed to be the case, never had been the case, and I, like I did every day, I walked in the front door, tried to, you know, screen door closed behind me, and I went to push the front door open. I was a little tiny thing, mm-hmm. and I couldn't push the door open because it was locked, and then I couldn't open the door behind me because I was stuck in there with my backpack or whatever, and I stayed that way for like 3 hours until the neighbor came and rescued me, and I found out, I don't even know at this time what happened, but I know I went and spent the afternoon and evening with the neighbors, who didn't know anything either at the time. And then my mother finally came back and showed up. And, you know, that was a one-time situation. It wasn't like that happened all the time, but I certainly profoundly remember that moment. And it, in so many ways, is also a bigger representation. So I get it. Anyway, any thoughts mm-hmm. on that?
Yeah. You know, that's the thing with trauma is, I think when people tend to think of trauma, they tend to think of what, you know, kind of like bigger type events, like a car accident or war or a sexual assault or, you know, a house fire, kind of major witnessing domestic violence, you know, these kinds of things. But the reality is what is considered traumatic, it varies from person to person. It varies from the age. Significant, like wildly. If you know, if that same experience had happened to you when you were 16 versus when you were five, yeah. you know, it would have been a very different impression. So how we internalize and process certain experiences at different ages really is significant. And that can cause a lot of, like you were saying, Angie, it's easy for a person to kind of minimize that experience because like, man, when I say it out loud, it sounds like maybe it shouldn't be that big of a deal. But the reality is if it was a big deal at that time for you, then it was a big deal at the time. And that's it. Like everybody's experience is different. And yep.
100%. So. Yep. And I just saw another one I wanted to touch. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Okay. I have a comment here from BB who says, but if back to the gal who's talking about therapy and everything. He says, if the spouse gets help and changes and is not a narcissist, then there's a chance for the marriage. And I just wanted to add to that. It's not even about if they're a narcissist or trying to figure that part of the puzzle out. It's because even if they're not a narcissist, if they don't have the emotional maturity to understand that they broke trust, and then if they don't have the desire or willingness to do the steps in order to repair the damage, then there's no chance.
Right. Exactly.
So, you know, it's the only way for a marriage to work is if two people are willing to do the work. And if each person has an accurate understanding of what their part in things is, it's when things get all tangled up and people have inappropriate expectations, or which is often the case with a narcissist, you've got one person who's taking on all of the responsibility for making the relationship work, which tends to be the partners of a narcissist.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, in fact, these two comments right here, one from Craig, one from UK lady, play right into that. Craig said, I keep hearing I'm just paranoid. And that's regarding, I believe, his father. UK lady says, I'm convinced mine is cheating. He says it's my BPD traits. So about that, what my point is, that sounds to me like it's projection and or gaslighting, depending on the situation, each case. But on that same note, I think with Linda, the one that was talking about, I think it was Linda that was talking about the counseling therapy with her husband. She said, that was my mindset about marriage, but the eggshell walking is horrible. I'm over it somewhat. I wanted to touch on that because I think looking at my own behavior in my own toxic mm-hmm. relationships, I definitely, especially in the marriage part, I didn't do this as much growing up because I was, you know, a rebel without a cause or whatever, but mm-hmm. I mean, not really, but I would like to see myself that way. But in the marriage, it became easier for me to just comply and accept and walk on eggshells. I thought I sort of did it initially thinking it would pass mm-hmm. like, okay, well, I'll just be super nice. And then he'll see that everything's okay. And then I'm cool. And I'm not, I'm not a problem or like the ex or whatever the crap was. And what happens in any relationship when how you come in is how they expect you to be. So I partially blame my own, like myself, for some of, not that I'm saying I actually blame myself, but on some level, I want to take responsibility for that, because maybe if I had stood up and done something different, it would have been a different relationship. But then on the other side of that, I recognize it wouldn't have been a relationship at all, because I would have had to bow out quickly when I realized that I was being actively emotionally abused. So, and I don't think that person would change. In fact, I know for sure that person would not become someone else. They would always have all these expectations and all of this entitlement, and you know what I mean? So, mm-hmm. but everyone's different, and I'm not saying everyone's a narcissist. I'm just saying that's what I guess the reason I brought that up is because I see a lot of people, you know, certainly we have some, you know, a lot of our circumstances are not because of ourselves. And I'm not saying that anything that happened in the relationship is because of ourselves, but I am saying that when we learn to have those boundaries, then and uphold them and love ourselves and do all this other, then we are not able to be in relationships like that, because we don't tolerate that behavior and we don't comply and we don't just accept and try to bend ourselves around someone in a way that's uncomfortable for us, but at least they don't get mad at us. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah. There's a quote I heard a while back, and it was something along the lines of, what you're saying about, you know, if we are like sacrificing our peace from within, mm-hmm. if we're sacrificing our inner peace to keep peace in our external environment, you know, like it's not worth it. And that's the whole thing with that, the eggshell walking. The whole point of that is to be like, I hope this ends soon, right? Like, I hope this blows over soon and things can get back to normal and there's no more tension there. But the reality is, if we're walking on eggshells, that tension has to go somewhere. So it's either in the environment or it's inside of us. And when we do get to that place where we're like, you know what, I don't want to live like this anymore. I don't want to feel tense and on edge and nervous and anxious and all of this. And I will not do this. So if an issue comes up that's not okay with me, mm-hmm. I'm going to address it tactfully. It's going to be brought up. It's going to be discussed. And if it's not discussed with appropriate, adult, mature conversation, because only that will lead to resolution. If it's not discussed and resolved, then it's potentially a deal breaker, because then you're saying, okay, because if it's not resolved, then it's going to just go back to crazy making in eggshells. And just like the gal was saying, she's convinced her this partner is cheating, but he's saying it's due to her BPD traits. Like, if we back that up a little bit, you know, it back it up to what is he doing that's making you uncomfortable?
Yep.
Right? Like the focus here doesn't need to be on you're convinced he's cheating and he's saying he's not cheating. Like we may never have the answer to that, but what we do have the answer to is he's doing something that's making you uncomfortable. Maybe he's liking pictures of sexy women on Facebook or just different women on Facebook and Instagram. He's has a quote unquote, a bunch of female friends. He's staying out late. He's hiding his phone, you know, these kinds of things, all of that squirrely behavior and all of that's appropriate to have an issue with.
Yeah.
So if he's not on the same page and sees nothing wrong, then in my book, that's a deal breaker. You know, and that's okay. Everybody's got their differences in what they consider okay. But if that's not okay with you, then that's like, that's not your, BPD. That's him wanting to do whatever he wants. And I don't know what he wants to do, but if he's doing squirrely stuff, you know, you don't need to prove that he's cheating. It's just doing squirrely stuff is a problem enough. So
you kill me with the squirrely. I love it so much. Okay, go on. I'm so sorry. It's not a funny topic. It's just a funny word. Moving
I know,
on.
It is a funny. I feel like it's such an accurate word.
It is.
And it's so just that dodgy behavior, you know, of like, oh no, yes. Everything's fine. It's like zigzagging squirrel in traffic.
Tree. I love
yes.
It. Yeah, it's just so funny. Squirrely. Okay. Go on. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, it's okay. That's all
squirrely
I got.
Stuff. Okay. All right. Woo. Okay. I have so many good comments. I just want to touch on two more and then we can wrap up if you have time. Do you have time?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Real quick. So I have one from, wait a minute. From Jack Lumen. And he talks about, I'm worried that with the chronic pain issues I deal with that have gotten worse, I might be going borderline. Well, I don't necessarily want to touch on the borderline part of that because we're running out of time, but maybe you're not. But I do want to touch on the chronic pain issue because I see that so much in our community. Mm-hmm. And I think it's almost, look, if you look at a cross section of people from the general public versus one of our community, there's a huge amount of, there's a much higher percentage of people with chronic pain, fibromyalgia, a lot of other different, I'm trying to think of the other names of them, but acquired type disorders, physical, mm-hmm. neurological type things. And I think there is significant because it speaks to the amount of trauma and the way that your brain reacts to the trauma and how our bodies develop as a result of it. Mm-hmm. And I think the longer we stay involved with these people and the longer we stay connected to these people and allow them to tell us who we are and how we feel, I think the higher our incidence will be for physical illness. I think we've all experienced some level, you know, even if you just get a little sick when you get stressed out, we all do, maybe not all of us, but a lot of people do, humans in general. You know, your immune system goes down when you don't feel well. I mean, when you're stressed out or whatever, but when it's a constant, like a slow burn, you know, I think the chronic pain issues will be, they're very, very common.
So, you know, it's one of those topics that I think is grossly understudied.
Yes.
And, but there's just a huge correlation to that stress. I think if anything, the big takeaway from that is the damage that stress can cause. Mm-hmm. And we all tend to walk around with like a low grade level of stress of just, there's just that stress that happens with daily life, bills and kids and, you know, pandemic and all kinds of stuff. But, realizing it's so, so important that we're able to carve out some peace in our life and to learn how to get rid of as much of that stress as we possibly can, because it really does take its toll. In fact, I was actually talking to my mom this morning. So I've been having like really bad neck pain for a long time. It's wild to me how long I can be in pain and not, and like minimize it. Mm-hmm. It's just weird. So anyways, it's finally caught up with me. My mom has degenerative disc disorder in her neck, and I do too. I called her this morning. I was like, hey, has yours gotten better? Did traction help? Like what all's helping? I'm throwing everything I can at this because it's just debilitating. And she said to me, she said, you know, it's interesting. She said, I really think the reason that my neck was hurting so bad, it was because of her second husband. And a lot of, and she's like, it went away after they divorced.
Wow.
And I think it was probably from clenching her jaw and the tightening of her shoulders.
Yeah.
Just exacerbated this issue that we both have. So yeah, it's very, very real.
Yeah.
Cutting out stress is a gift that we can give ourselves as much as we possibly can.
Absolutely. Totally agree. And one more question before we go, and it's going to be, we'll touch on it very, very quickly because the answer is about this long. Much Dutch says, I've been in an abusive relationship now in my mid 40s, I no longer want to date because I'm afraid to repeat the pattern. I'm content being single and living in peace. Am I avoiding? No. You're allowed to live in peace and be content. As long as you're happy, you don't need to be in a relationship. Society and our basic human nature might tell us that we should be in a relationship at any given moment in our lives. But I feel like if you're happy, you're content, you're good, girl or guy. I don't even know. Whatever you are, you're good. Yeah. Dana, thoughts?
I would agree with you completely. Like, you set the pace.
Yes.
You know, absolutely. So, I have to agree, you know, the older we get in life, the kind of, a lot of that, the reality of a relationship is more complicated. There tends to be kids and stepkids and, you know, there's a lot more to take into consideration. And it's perfectly okay to say, like, I really want to have some level of relationship with this other person. Mm-hmm. But here's where my line is with what I'm comfortable with and what I'm not comfortable with.
Right.
You set the pace. You don't need to explain this or justify it to anybody, just like Angie was saying.
And if you're happy, that's all that matters. And I see Ms. Bryant also is no longer interested in dating. And, you know, and I think this is an ongoing, I think a lot of women and men, you know, at a certain point, especially when they've been through relationships like this, they're like, no, thanks, I'm all right. And if you choose to move forward later and be in a relationship or look for a relationship, okay. But if you don't, you know what? It's okay. Be happy. That's all. Be yourself. Be happy. Mm-hmm. Don't let society or anyone tell you you must be this or you need to be that or you need to think this or do that or whatever. As long as you're like within the law, reasonably speaking, relatively speaking, you're good. And I support your choice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you have anything else you want to say before we wrap up for today?
No, I was kind of thinking maybe we should end on a question though. There's lots of people in the chat that are talking the whole concept of physical pain as a response to stress is
a big one.
So I guess maybe what's one thing that we could close on is just kind of asking people, what have you experienced? What has been the connection you've seen in your life, either, I guess, through yourself or through others, the correlation between physical pain and stress?
That's the question of the day. Let us know in the chat or in the comments below if you have questions you want to ask us for our next session, which I believe will be 1 week from today on Dana's channel. Yes. Unless that's not a holiday, is it? No.
I don't think so.
Okay. No? Well, if it's Christmas Eve, I can't count today. No, it's not a holiday. Okay. Yeah, we'll be over there 1 week from today on Dana's channel, Thrive After Abuse, right here on YouTube. And make sure you subscribe to this channel with the bell notification and Dana's channel with the bell notification. You can also, as backup, because sometimes YouTube doesn't send notifications in time, you can also send a text to Angie Live, all one word, A-N-G-I-E-L-I-V-E, to 33222, or Dana Live, and or to be notified of both of our streams together and separate. Dana Live, all one word, D-A-N-A-L-I-V-E, at, what was it, Dana?
22999.
Perfect. All right. And thank you guys. Let us know if you have questions, like I said, in the chat or in the comments below when this is posted later. And we will try to answer them during our next session. And please tell us your thoughts about, you know, chronic pain or any other sort of physical ailment that you developed or may have developed as a result of some form of trauma or abuse in your life that was not physical. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. All right.
Good deal.
Thanks, Dana, so much. I'll see you next week.
Thank you. Yeah. All take right. care. Okay.
All right. Thanks, bye. Everybody.